Welcome to another edition of the Built for the Storm podcast. Hosted by three-time World Series champion Jeremy Affeldt.
Affeldt brings it. Chopper on the infield. Affeldt to the bag himself.
Get ready to experience life's winding journey through the minds of proven leaders in the worlds of sports, business, and entertainment.
And he strikes out. That's four straight for Affeldt. Can't do it any better than Jeremy Affeldt.
As they draw up your own personal playbook to overcoming the odds
and achieving real success.
We just don't give up. We don't quit. You know how we pieced everything together, man. Seeing teams win like this, the way we win.
What's the best way to weather a storm? Run into it head on, charging full steam ahead.
This is unbelievable. You know, game seven. I mean, this will be a memory for a long time for me. I'm so happy I got to come to the park today.
Here's the fearless leader of our pack, Jeremy Affeldt.
I have an awesome guest on, and usually I've had guests on prior to men's night, but I had a third Thursday men's night that we have here at the brewery, Free Roam Brewing Company, every third Thursday of the month. And he was introduced to me by a common friend who comes to our men's nights and said, I think you need to have this guy on. He's great. He's a public speaker. He's got a storm. I was like, well, I need to know a little bit more than that. He gave me some background. I met with this man and he was awesome. I said, man, I need to do a podcast because this is a really cool story. My guest today is Tyson Devers, and he has an interesting storm because he's paralyzed. And a lot of people, when they want to talk about storms, I'm paralyzed, you're thinking, you'll assume right out the gate, drunk driving storm or reckless driving storm or stuff like that. And what you'll hear from Tyson is this is a, hey, this storm just hit him. He did nothing wrong and some crazy stuff happened. It wasn't out of being reckless or anything like that. And we take storms on. And when Built for the Storm podcast, if it's your first time or your 10th time listening, I'll remind you, we don't talk about successes as much on these podcasts as we talk about the human life. So we talk about storms, how they approach us, how we learn from storms, how they shaped us. Sometimes storms aren't always all our fault. And how do we learn from those and not give up? How do we keep charging storms knowing it's going to bring back to us a quality of life that we're all desiring and having being happy no matter what? So we want to talk about that. He has a book. He's an author. It's called Trauma is a Team Sport. Pretty awesome. You'll understand that here shortly. He's a public speaker, but I am excited to have him on because it was an intriguing story. Because when some people come up to me and they say, I got a guy that you should speak, everybody has a guy that should
speak. Yeah,
right?
You probably get that a lot.
Yeah, so you're like, all right, you know, it is what it is. So I kind of asked for some background on it. Then when I met you, it's just intriguing because I'm going to let you tell a little bit of your story, but what I really appreciated about the story was there's not a victim mentality with you. I did not feel at all. I felt like there was a, hey man, this is the card that fell. This is the blow that life dealt me, and it is what it is, and I still have to function, and I could live. You could have went the other way. You chose not to, and you're finding joy in that. And that's kind of what was most intriguing to me. And also why I want you on this podcast is because we talk a lot about how storms aren't always our fault. And a lot of times we've had people on here have been abused, abandoned, tragedy hits, jobs, marriage losses, all those things. And we've had Columbine, I guess from Columbine, we've had 9/11, a young lady whose husband was in the 10 building across the street. He was on the first guys up, never came back. Those kind of tragedies. So there have been some great ones, but this one's a little different for me because this is basically you're minding your own business and it happened. So I want to get into that a little bit. And if you're listening, this is a good one for all of us because this is a perfect example of, hey man, it is not exactly what happens to us in this storm. It's how we react to the storm. And yep. I know you want to talk a lot about that. So let's get into it. So Tyson, you were sitting here in my podcast room in a wheelchair. You are very self-sufficient watching you just get yourself around. You can do what you do. You don't look at it as a victim mentality, but tell us what happened. I mean, I heard the 911 call at the men's night, and just so y'all know, this 911 call was crazy when it came in, but I kind of want you, because we don't have the 911 call on the podcast, kind of describe your situation, the storm that hit you, and we'll get into it here because it's a really intriguing story for me.
Yeah, for sure. So it was March 11, 2005. It was the day we got out for spring break. I'm going to school at Texas State there in San Marcos. And day we got out for spring break, I'm gonna pick up my girlfriend at the time. We're gonna go to the beach like all college kids do. So I'm on a 2-lane road. I'm a West Texas guy, so I don't like the hustle and bustle and the interstates. So I always took the back roads. It's exactly what I did. I'm on a 2-lane road in the right-hand lane, waiting on oncoming traffic so I can make a left-hand turn into her neighborhood. And behind me is a single cab truck. Gets started waiting, so goes around on the shoulder of the road. And behind him comes a fully loaded concrete truck going 70 miles an hour. And, man, he hit my car from behind. And if you can picture Bigfoot, the big monster truck, I mean, he went right over the top of it. Mm. And when he did, he knocked me into oncoming traffic where I was hit head-on by a Nissan Xterra coming the other way. So got hit twice, still 100% conscious, trapped in the car. Could feel the heat and the fire and didn't know what happened, but I knew it was bad, right? And I knew I had to get out of there because I was about to burn up. And so I turned myself around and I was going out the back passenger side of the car. And the best way I can describe that part is I get asked a lot, like, what was it like? Did you hear anything? Did you feel anything? Didn't feel a whole lot, really. Just fighting, trying to get out of there. And, you know, the feeling you get when somebody socks you in the nose, I mean, you're kind of, you know, disoriented for a little while. That's exactly what I had. And then my legs were just, like, tingling like crazy. Almost that feeling like if your foot falls asleep, you stand up, you get that needle feel in the bottom of your feet. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how my legs were 24/7. I mean, they still are 24/7, but that's how they were that day. And luckily, one of the guys in the single cab truck saw it happen. He comes running up to my car. And, you know, Ryan's a smaller guy, 5'7", 5'8", probably 140 pounds.
So you know the name of the guy. I mean, you still know the name.
I still talk to these guys every March 11th. We talk more than that, but we for sure talk on March 11th. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Ryan tries to get me out. He can't do it. And then two more guys passing by work for ESPN Radio, Daryl O'Neill and Philip Breedlove. They see the wreck happen, so they come running up. And Daryl reached in and grabbed me by my belt. And Philip took the door panel of my car that was laying on the ground, picked it up, jumped into my burning car, and shielded the flames with that door panel, and then grabbed my feet from what was left of the pedals. And then Ryan and Daryl pulled me up out of the car. And that's when I lost consciousness the first time. So ended up flatlining four times that day. Twice on the scene, once in the helicopter, and once on the operating table.
But what kind of car were you driving?
I was driving a Corvette. So I got it December the 18th, and my wreck happened March 11th.
So fiberglass, pretty much. There's not a lot of protection in that car.
No, it just completely exploded. In fact, when we had experts come back and recreate the accident, it's not an accident, it was a wreck, but we had two experts come back and look at it, and both of them come back and said, the design of that car saved your life, believe it
really?
Or not. Yep. Everything collapses around those two seats, so that's what it did. It was a coupe, so I had the top off that day. And
that's just gnarly. You didn't get like your head taken off. Everything just went over you.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the pictures of my car, and you would think that I was mangled and burned up, and that wasn't the case. I mean, I had a scratch between my eyes, a few minor burns, a little notch taken out of my right ear, and I mean, that's it.
And so if people are listening, can they Google that? Can they go find I usually do this at the end, but it's really intriguing. I don't want people to forget. Can they go see where your car is? They just Google your name. Can they see what the car looks like?
Yeah, just go to my website, TysonDeaver.com. There's a picture of it there. There's a short video that has the 911 call on it.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. If you're listening, I'm telling you, it is a crazy call. It is crazy. But I want to go back to, you know, the names. That's just crazy to me. Like, because a lot of times we see wrecks all the time. Even people that save people from wrecks and get out and help, that doesn't mean you ever know names. How long after this did you have to find these guys? Did they go to the hospital with you? Like, how would you even be able to track the? Because it's like you said, you're conscious, but you're rattled. Then there's a lot of chaos. You've died five times. It's not like you're like, oh man, I'm gonna go. You know, I remember those guys. Like, there's a lot of stuff that took place there. So how do you connect with those guys? How'd that even happen?
Yeah, they showed up to the hospital.
Really?
Yeah. They came up there, and Daryl, he doesn't talk about it to this day. I mean, we had to get it out of him to write the book and get his side of things. But, you know, like even if we're out to dinner, he won't talk about it. But, you know, he went back to work and, I mean, they're smelling like gasoline.
Oh, man.
I mean, just everything was burned, you know. So, I mean, they can smell and everybody's like, what happened? He's like, nothing. We just went to lunch, come back, you know. But they ended up coming to the hospital. And, man, to be honest, like, I owe my life to these guys. Like,
sure.
They risked their life to save me that day. Because without them, I'm not here.
That's
right. They pulled me out of the car. My car literally explodes into flames. And without them doing what they did, I'm not here. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a good chance I'm not here. And so it was important to me to know who these guys are. Like, why did they do what they did? You know, I mean, they just jumped into action without even thinking. And then when you hear the 911 call, one of the things you're going to hear is there's a guy that called in and they said, you're in the accident. He said, yeah, I was part of it. Well, that's the guy in the Xterra, the second guy that I hit. Okay. So he had a broken nose. And then there was a couple guys on the scene that they were trying to recruit guys like, hey, help us get him out. They couldn't do it. You know, they just froze. And, you know, Ryan talks about that in the book a little bit. He's like, yeah, I couldn't understand why these guys wouldn't come help us, but
yeah,
they didn't know what to do. I mean, they just froze.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was important for me to know who these guys are. I think it was the first year, March 11th, we had a big dinner barbecue thing where we all got together, and I gave them this little clock that has March 11th of 2005 on it. Just a kind of a, I don't want to go back and remember the day, but I think it's important to know that that's kind of a new foundation for me, right?
Sure. Life changed that day. It wasn't what you were thinking it was going to be. It's kind of a life.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you'd asked me when I was 22 when this happened. So if you'd asked me when I first turned 22, which way my life is headed, I probably would have pointed off to my right, you know, yeah, in that direction. Then all of a sudden, snapping the fingers, and my life is headed a totally different direction.
Yeah. So Ryan is the one that went around you, right?
Yeah, he was the guy in the single cab truck.
I mean, I look at it from sometimes different perspectives, right? So I'm like, man, I went around you, and that cement truck hit you 70 miles an hour. Maybe if he didn't want to go around you, then the truck would have saw it. He was going 70, so he was going to get it. It's not like the truck was ready to stop.
Right.
So going around you, that just made the truck hit you, but he was going to get hit. I mean, that truck was not paying attention, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I was just thinking, has he ever expressed like dealing with guilt? Not in going around you, but there's survival's guilt, or there's like, oh my gosh, I'm walking because I went around somebody and somebody else isn't, and this guy should have hit me. I just wonder about that
stuff. Yeah, he hadn't said anything about that. He was a passenger in that car. So there was another guy driving. I haven't met him, but Ryan's the one that jumped out to come get me. And then there was two girls in the truck as well, and they were headed to spring break too.
Got you.
And, man, I learned a lot when we wrote the book because, you know, you start digging deep and hearing people's stories, and Ryan had a tough time talking about it, but as he was going through it, he said, man, I jumped out of the car or the truck and I was running up to your car. I kind of looked over at the concrete truck and I knew I had to go to you. And he said, I was absolutely terrified because between my truck that I was in your car, there was a baseball cap laying on the ground and it was face down, like sitting upright, you know?
So he's afraid what he's going to see.
He thought my head was in there.
Yeah.
And he was terrified. And I'm like, dude, I learned this when we were writing the book, and I'm like, jeez, I mean, that's intense right there, you know?
Yeah.
So he got up closer and then he could hear me screaming, get me out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know if anybody was there or not, but I couldn't get out by myself.
So yeah.
I was hoping and praying that somebody was there. And luckily Ryan and Daryl and Philip showed up.
That is gnarly to me, man. Yeah. Now that makes more sense. The passenger, you never met the driver. Cause I just wonder, I would feel, the only reason I put myself in those people's shoes, right? I would like, oh my gosh, like I'd feel something in a way. Selfishly, you're like, I'm thankful. But in another way, you're like, I shouldn't be thankful because I should have been there or I could have been there. Like, it's a huge battle to like have to address that, you know, and they didn't know whether you were going to live or die probably.
Yeah.
So they, you know, all that stuff. But now we got the cement truck. He was fine.
Yeah, he went to the hospital. They released him that night. So yeah, he wasn't hurt too bad.
But he didn't do it. Like, you had to go to court, right? You had to go.
You go through litigation, all that. We went to a mediation. You know, you go into a mediation room. It's a long table, a bunch of lawyers on one side, a mediator, and then your family and you. And, you know, he comes in. His wife's helping him walk. He's, like, with a walker or a cane. And, you know, it's a perfect chance for him to say, I'm sorry. I hate your guts. Mm-hmm. Here's what I was doing. A head nod, something. He didn't even look at me. Mm-hmm. Like, didn't acknowledge that I was even in the room. And I get it. I get it. I mean, I'm sure his lawyer said, don't you say a word.
Yeah.
You know, but I know on the flip side of that, I'm human and I would have to do something, you know, to say, I'm sorry or,
yeah.
You know. And I'm not bitter. I'm really not. And
yeah.
I haven't been, but I would like to know what he's doing. I mean, he's going 70 through a school zone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, he's distracted. He's not paying attention. And, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could imagine. I could see from the business side of it. They're like, don't say anything because this lawsuit's, you know, it that's what it is. It's like crazy. It's a business vehicle. You have to go through that. But you're right. It would be hard for me not to even look at you, tear up. I wouldn't have to admit anything. It's just sad.
Yeah.
You know, like for him to have done that. And I could only imagine it had to have affected him a little bit. But I'm hearing a lot of things. I'm hearing thankful. I remember these guys. We talk all the time. Heroes. And then you said, I get it when someone doesn't even want to look at you, the person that ran over you, pretty much. I get it. So these are all things that aren't bitter. You took the storm on and you said, I have to react the right way. Essentially, it's forgiveness, thankfulness. There's a lot of things in a positive thing, because that's why I think when I see you or I talk with you or I hear you speak, you're holding your head up high. There isn't this, I'm going to find a way to get back or to attack back. Even starting, I know this is going to sound bad, but even starting like a smart driving or fighting for something to happen when a work vehicle hits you, like we need to have different policies. You're not even doing that. You're doing other things now that are proactive for other people that have had similar situations to you and what you're doing. And you're going out, you're speaking, you're uplifting, you're a part of another organization that I want to talk about that's pretty awesome. You're very proactive. So was that always in you? Is that kind of how you think anyway? Or is this like a, man, I had to come to that reality that I could live bitter or I could live in a positive? It's a mentality. It's hard to grasp.
I'm a firm believer that who you are as a person before adversity hits determines how you respond to it. And to be honest, the best way I can answer that, this is a credit to my parents. They raised me right. They laid that foundation that when my back was against the wall, because it was, I'm rock bottom at that point. You know, I'm 22 years old and go from being 6 foot tall to 3'9" in a wheelchair. That's a huge hit on a 22-year-old's ego. But when you're at that point, the only thing you can fall back on is that foundation, right? And it was my parents for raising me right. Those lessons learned on the football field, on the baseball field of being resilient and fighting and you know, life isn't given to you. You have to go out and earn it. You have to make it happen. And that was put on display big time at that point.
Yeah. So athletes, you know, when we think, you know, I can see where you're coming from, because when we think, there's the storm, the controllable versus the uncontrollable. The athlete that doesn't function very well or doesn't ever really become an athlete, they play sports. But playing sports and being an athlete are two different things. And I think most people would agree with that. But an athlete thinks about controllable versus uncontrollable. An athlete thinks, when we're not mentally strong, we focus on an uncontrollable. But we just have the ability to refocus on controllables. The uncontrollable is like, well, this is the situation that I've been dealt. And I can sit there and focus on that situation and complain about that situation. Or I can say, well, that's a situation, but I don't need to focus on that. I need to focus on solutions. I need to focus on what is my controllable in the situation I'm in. And how can I use that controllable to get me through that situation and hopefully succeed in that situation? So it's kind of like, I see how that's how you were thinking. Like your situation, one you lived, you want to live. Because most people die for way less than that, man.
For sure.
And your body fought to live 5 times. Yeah. So there's something in you that said, I want to live.
100%.
Or you wouldn't have lived.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So you have that. And then you have, this is my situation. I'm going to connect. I want to get to know the guys that helped me, because I want to tell them I appreciate it. You know, I want to actually put myself in that driver's shoes of that truck and be like, man, I don't know if I would have handled it like you, but I get how you are handling it like you do. Like, and not putting yourself in your shoes looking at him, you're putting yourself in his shoes looking at you, saying, I can see why you went that route. It's probably not how I would do it, but I can see how you went that route. Now you're through it. Crazy. 22. How long did it take you to get to this point now? Was it not, this is what I'm going to do, or was there a time of you had to, how long did it take you to process everything out to get you on some of this road of writing book, public speaking, doing stuff for nonprofits? Like, where was that transition timeline?
Man, it happened really quick for me. And it's a conscious decision that each person makes. Like, I remember making it, my parents are coming into the hospital room for the first time, and I immediately notice, look, they're reading me, right? If I'm good, they're good. If I'm not good, they're not good. And so I had to ask my mom like 9 or 10 times, am I paralyzed? And finally she said yes, after saying, you know, or just kind of diverting the question. And first thing I said was, Mom, that's all right. I'll just go play wheelchair basketball. You know, but I understand that I have to be strong for them. And one of the first things I said to my high school principal who came and saw me in the hospital was, you know, before I could do 10,000 things, now I can do 9,000. Let's focus on the things that I can do. And I know that sounds cliche, and I'm a motivational speaker, and you know, you're supposed to say those things, but that's one of the first things I said before I even knew what I was really saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going to school to be a teacher and a coach. I ended up doing that for 2 years. But at the end of the day, I felt like there was more that I could give. I did that for two, and then in 2009 started speaking full time. But it all happened really, really fast for me. I spent 3 weeks in the hospital. I went to rehab for 3 weeks, went home for a month till I got my back brace off, went back for 3 more weeks. Rec happened in March. I'm back in school in August, finished my degree. So the important thing for me was, can't change what happened to me. Let's go get back to life. I mean, let's just go make the best of it. And really didn't know what that looked like, you know, but you just kind of go for it.
It is a conscious decision, because you see a lot of people that, and some people get to where you're at. They just don't get to it that quick, right? Like they're, that is, like you said, that is something that your parents built in you probably from young. That is probably why you were being able to be a college athlete, an athlete at a college level. I mean, there's a lot of athletes that get to high school to be a collegiate athlete and move on past that. It thins out pretty quick. So to even be at a college athlete level, you got to have that personality and that drive and that discipline to make that decision right away. And I know I would probably say there's a lot of people that probably don't even do that. It takes a little, man, that's a lot to process through. For you to get on it like that is very impressive. But I also think it's a testament to all of us, in myself included. Sometimes I've boo-hooed certain situations, right? And I've stayed on it too long. But I think it's a testament to those things of like, man, if you can make that decision quick, your life and your healing and your anything, emotional healing, the trauma, like you said, man, you know, trauma is a team sport.
Yeah,
it is trauma. So how do I heal from trauma fast so that I can be the best of my life, so I don't waste 10 years of my life dealing with trauma that I can't control? It was an uncontrollable. So the book, Trauma is a Team Sport. Why the title?
You got to surround yourself with good people. You got to have a team. I don't care if you're what you do. If you're the president of the United States, nobody gets to the top by themselves. And if they say they did, they're wrong, right? You got to build yourself a great team. And that's why, I mean, everything we do, life, you got to have a team. You got to have, surround yourself with, you know, for us guys, it's important for us to have a group of guys that we can go to, vent to, hang out with, whatever. But that's your guys, right?
That's right.
That's your team. Man, that's so important. And a lot of times we are who our team is. So, you know, who we hang out with, who we're socializing with, that's a direct reflection of us and our values, really. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, especially in this situation, you don't get where I was at that day on March 11, 2005 to today by yourself. It doesn't happen like that.
That's right. I mean, herd, man. You need a herd mentality, man. It's that whole buffalo mentality, that whole charging storms. Like, it's a perfect picture of that. And you're charging a crazy one. And you did. Charge a crazy one. But like you said, I do like that, man. You need people. We need community. And that's what I've pushed at the brewery. I've pushed on podcasts. None of these storms, no storm that we've ever heard on a podcast, any storm that we talk about at the brewery, nothing is solo. Nothing is, I did it by myself. Nothing goes well by yourself. It does not work, because you are your worst enemy. And your brain is super powerful, man, and it can trick you. It can trick you, even if it's a good situation. It can make you think it's a bad situation. You can get into self-doubt, what-ifs, and you need people to come in and be like, from the outside looking in, that's not what I see. This is what I see. You are in your own head, but people else are like, no, this is what I see, and we can do this, and we've got you, and we're here for you, and we're going to push you. We're going to hold you accountable, because I'm sure there's some guys in your life you've given permission to, right? Maybe I'm wrong, but you can get into a boohoo and you've got certain guys that you have permission to be like, hey man, you're not boohooing this situation. Get out of it.
Like, yeah. I mean, one of my best buddies, Garrett George, you know, you met Garrett. He's one of those guys for me. I mean, he's quick to call me out, you know? I mean, I lost my dad in 2020 to cancer, and I'll never forget one of the things he said when he was going through treatment. He said, Tyson, it's all right to get down, but don't stay there. And man, that was powerful for me. You know, I mean, it's all right to give yourself a minute down in that valley, but I mean, at some point you got to pull yourself back up and get to that mountaintop. And, you know, he's battling through cancer and still has the courage to say that, but something powerful that he told me, but it's true.
Yeah. Oh man, you're right, man. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying this sucks, because if you can't say that, you're not being real. So you can't get past something if you're not vulnerable enough to say, no, this sucks. It really sucks. For right now.
Yeah.
But I got to get past where it doesn't suck.
Yep.
And like you said, trauma, you know, is a team sport. I think that's so good. And I think that teams are important. And when we talk, like, I like how you say it's a team sport, because everybody thinks sports is just, well, you're on a field of play or you're on a court, right? Like, you're not, they're not thinking life. Life in general really is a sport, because it's a survival thing. You are here put in different situations. I mean, it's why I like golf. I try to tell my middle son, like, hey, when you hit a ball, you could be like a lot of guys. I've done it. You could find, drop a ball, found it, and put it in a great spot. You could do that. Or you could say, this spot sucks.
Yeah.
Now what? And work on getting out of that spot and hitting it low. I was in Scotland playing golf one time. My buddies, and I was not ready to play golf. I was not a good enough golfer. I didn't start playing golf really until I was retired. I mean, I messed with it a little bit, but not really focused on it. And I went like a year and a half after I retired, go to Scotland. Probably not what you want to do. And I remember an old guy was with me, right? He was a caddy, because all those places have, he's a little 75-year-old man walking around with me. And we had heavy winds, hurricane winds. It was like 70 miles. Most people weren't even playing. We went out because we paid to go out. And I remember I hit a ball bad one time, and it went way off. Well, I hit a lot of bad balls, but this one instance, I hit a bad ball, and I went over and I found it. I said, I found it. And he's like, he walks up, and he's like, huh, that's great that you found that ball. I'm like, yeah, thanks. He's like, where's the other one? And I say, excuse me? He goes, where's the one that was in your pocket? Because you had a ball when you're in your pocket. I just want to make sure you still have that ball in your pocket. And I went, what? He's like, the one that's in your pocket. If you found the ball you hit, then the other one should be in your pocket. I reach into my pocket and I pull it out. And he's like, all right. He goes, I just want to let you know, I'm going to call you out the entire time. We do not cheat. You play it where it lies. And I'll tell you how to do it, just like you need mentors in life to help you get through. I mean, it was like, honestly, the coolest 18 holes I've ever been on in my life. I took pictures with the guy. I'm like, you're the coolest old man ever. Because that's that process, like what your dad said, you can be down, but don't stay there, man. Figure it out.
Yeah.
Figure out how to get out of it. And you figured it out. So you have passions. Did you like to write, or is it just something that I got to tell the story? And so, like, I have ghostwriters. I got things to say, but I don't have time to write.
Same. I can speak, but I can't write. So I collaborated with Sarah Paulk. She's a writer, and it was actually my parents' preacher's wife.
Okay.
And when my wreck happened, my mom was doing her mom's hair. Of all things. So kind of a crazy line of events, but she's a writer. I sat down with her and, you know, I said, look, I want to write a book. Is this something you're interested in? And she come back and she said, I hope you don't mind, but I wrote the first chapter. And she's like, you don't have to use it, but I wrote it. So I read it and I'm like, dude, my brain's not wired like that.
Yeah,
you know, like I can't do that. So,
she
would write chapters and we just collaborated on it. I gave her the meat and potatoes and she put the fluff into it, but she would write things. And I'm like, how did you know to write that? You know, like that's things that I say when I'm on stage speaking, and she's like, oh, well, I just put it in there. So, you know, it was meant to be, but yeah, definitely not a writer. I can speak, but I can't write. But
so you love to speak. You like to tell story. I can tell that, like just kind of principles through story, which is super important. People relate, I believe, to a story rather than I've noticed in public speaking when I do it too, the story is what keeps people intrigued. If you try to have a bullet point presentation and you go off in notes and you're just looking down your notes, you'll lose everybody. But story, it doesn't matter if they're think like you, act like you, or in the same stuff as you. If you tell story and apply principle, people really enjoy that a lot more. So I do think you like to do that. But you like to do other things. You're helping out a nonprofit. I went to it the other day. It was awesome. And for people, you know, on here, we'll have a lot of guests. Hey, here's the reality. You can turn it off if you want, but people hunt, all right? So anybody you want to get offended on the hunting, it is what it is. People do it. We eat what we kill. We hunt it. We have a good time. It's part of being in the outdoors. It's part of it. You want to call it harvest, fine, but we do that. It is a real thing, and it's therapeutic for people to be in the outdoors, and everybody's in the outdoors in different ways, shape, or form. But you're a part of an organization that does do different ways. It's not just hunting. It's getting outdoors. But you're a part of an organization that has helped a lot. And it helps a lot with some of these traumatic events because it is a team sport. And so tell me a little bit about the nonprofit that you were a part of or are a part of. And how did you get into that?
Yeah, 100% it is. It's called Disabled Outdoorsmen USA. It's an organization that takes disabled people like myself, guy, girl, whatever. Hunting, fishing, kayaking, camping, anything in the outdoors. I mean, if somebody has a wish to do something in the outdoors, Weston and those guys over at Disabled Outdoorsmen USA, they do what they can to make it happen. And I've been fortunate enough to be on a couple trips with them. I went red fishing in Port O'Connor, and then I also went to North Carolina on a red fishing trip. Mm. And man, let me tell you, these trips are so much more than just going fishing or just going hunting or kayaking or whatever. These trips are truly changing lives, right? I mean, you get guys who, there was a guy from the Abilene, Texas area, and he was struggling. He was having a tough time, and his girlfriend at the time reached out to me and said, can you help him? I'm like, I don't know. I'll try, you know? And so I reached out to Weston, and within 2 weeks, they had him on a trip to the Texas coast fishing. And
that's awesome.
Then we took him to North Carolina on that red fishing trip. And dude, he's a different person, right? But he was able to ask people like myself. I've been in chair for, March will be 19 years. Hmm. So he's able to ask me, hey, how do you do this? How do you do that? And I could also tell him, hey, why don't you try this? This is a shortcut, you know? You know, he's still traveling with a shower chair. And I'm like, dude, you don't have to do that, right? You can get into a shower. Well, he don't know. The only thing he knows is what they taught him in rehab. And so, man, there's so many good things going on these trips. And it's so much more than, you know, fishing or hunting. Like I said, it's truly life-changing.
Yeah. And they go all over, right? Wherever, it doesn't matter.
There's different chapters. I mean, I think the ultimate goal is for them to have a DOSA chapter in each state across the United States. I think they're at, it's either 7 or 9 right now. So, the word's getting out. And I mean, you were at the banquet a couple weeks ago. It was awesome.
It was awesome. And I just appreciated the support. And I think that, you know, for me, I'm a big outdoorsman. I would prefer to be outside than inside. I don't like being inside a whole lot. I like being in the, you know, in Texas. I always tell people I got the best of both worlds. I'm from the Northwest. Came down here from Spokane, Washington, on the east side of the state, and border Idaho, where there's tons of my family still lives up there. And when it gets super hot here and I got to punch out, I got a place to go. My wife was living in Sheridan, Wyoming before this. And there's so many cool hikes in the mountains. So many people she knows from up there. We love being outside, and it's very therapeutic. You know, so we have awesome hill country, Texas, for the majority of the year. It gets too hot. Boom, we punch out and hike and do our thing and get outside, and we get our boys outside. But man, being outside is just a good way to process life in general. And so for organizations that want to figure out a way to help, I mean, I saw so many. I mean, just walking up, you see, man, these gun blinds that they just help you get into through ramps. And so many people are finding a way to, like, hey, life doesn't, they might look different, but you still can enjoy some of the same exact things. We just got to put our heads together and help you figure it out. And there's the teamwork, right? That's the team process there. And what I saw there was really, really cool. You know, I just saw a lot of people, more than I thought were going to be there. That was an incredible showing. People that are get together that are wanting to just pour into people's lives, because I think everybody there understands that even in a non-disabled situation, we can all become mentally disabled. So we all know we get stuck in our head. We got to get outside, man. We got to get some fresh air. We've got to figure out a way to value life better than the hustle and bustle of going to an office, going up a street, dealing with traffic, sitting in a brewery, whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. You've got to get to a point where at some point in time, you can just, like, hear the water hitting a boat or lapping against the shore or hearing birds or watching animals run. And because if you're a true hunter, it's not about the hunt. It's about watching things take place in front of you and watching how things move and animals just process through life. And you see the survival of the fittest mentality when you're out. It's just a really cool feeling to have, and we all need it. And so for me, I just thought that outcome was really, really cool. So I thought that was great. So next steps for you, like a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan, I know I'm putting you on the spot, but do you close your eyes and say, man, in 10 years, this is where I want to be? Do you have that?
Yeah, I think for me, it's continuing to do what I do and speak. I would like to be on more of a national level. So I think it's just pushing the envelope, you know, getting out there, getting out of your comfort zone, getting on the big stage, you know, I mean, and I do some conferences here, and a lot of what I do is speak to schools, but I'd like to continue doing what I'm doing, but on a bigger scale. And you know, the Zig Ziglars of the world, and I mean, that's where you have to strive to be, right? I mean,
yeah.
I can't get on stage and talk about complacency if I'm being complacent myself. So I just want to keep pushing that and just be the best that I can be, really.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. There's a lot of hope out there. I mean, you've helped some of our friends. We have similar friends that just, you know, they deal with, you know, PTSD and certain scenarios like that. And I think that when we go through a storm, one of the things that I have noticed is when we go through certain storms, it allows us to have compassion for certain situations that maybe we wouldn't have had compassion for. Some people give to it, but a lot of people, man, you see some of these people when they really jump on board with something like pediatric cancer, it's either because their child had it or they got a friend that had it so much that it was like, we got to help. Yeah. So now you're jumping on board because you walked through that storm, right? Like you walked through that and for trauma to happen and things that like, I just did life and this happened to me. Compassion hits differently for different people. And it's not a negative thing. It's not bad that you don't jump onto something until something happens to you. That's not a bad thing. That's just a process of like, that's how life takes us, right? That we have passions for certain things because we're a lot of times we're connected to those things. So for you to go out and we have, like I said, we have similar, you know, friends that I know you've helped out and the organization's helping out and even having people participate in helping out. I mean, some of these guys are military guys, but they're not disabled, but they want them out there helping disabled because they're running the same gauntlet that just looks different, man.
Yeah.
Like they're still in their own head. They're still feeling like they're lost or forgotten or hope is dwindling. It's still the same.
Yeah.
So you gain those passions. So for you to do that, man, I think that's incredible. I appreciate your willingness to do that and want to do it at a national level because this is such a bad deal right now. Trauma, man, it was not really highlighted in our country for a really, really long time. But trauma is it's a terrible thing. It really is. Mental illness is a terrible thing. And it happens to great people, man.
Yeah.
And it's simply because they get lost in their own head and they don't feel like anybody's wanting to help them and they can't get hope, you know? And so you going out and even bringing hope that way is super, super important. So I appreciate what you wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to live in a negative world when your focus is on helping others. And the value in that is, you know, if you place your life goals and your ambitions on really helping other people and genuinely doing that, dude, what you get back is so much more. I'm a motivational speaker and people say, well, you've got it figured out, right? You're doing good. No, man. And there's still days where it's hard for me to get out of bed.
I'm sure.
Put myself in a wheelchair. But, you know, when you put your focus on others, and I know that sounds cliche, but it's true. A lot of good comes back to you too.
Yeah, because I think the distraction is get away from your selfishness. When we're dealing with whatever we're struggling with and you're having a hard time get out of bed because you're like, dude, I look at that wheelchair and I'm like, seriously, that is actually a selfish scenario, sure. Right? But it's normal. It's normal to feel that way. But then when you're thinking, but when I get in this wheelchair, I'm going to help all those people. And then you transfer that focus. Seems like that wheelchair is probably more doable. When I'm very thankful from where I'm at. And there are days where I'm like, I get in my own head and I get frustrated with how life's coming at me or dealing me certain blows. And I'm like, but that's selfish, man. You're thinking about you right here. How about think about the people that you're going to help or the brewery, the community that you have to go, you want to be a part of and you're trying to create for other people, your kids, focus on your kids or your wife or doing these. Man, then it gets you out of that whole like, you know, but man, we get trapped in that selfishness, man. It's a down. It never ends well. Yeah. It does not.
Man, I think here at Free Room, I mean, you have the opportunity. You don't know who's going to walk through that door, right? That's right. So, I mean, you have a chance to literally change somebody's life every single day.
That's right.
All over having a beer, sitting there talking, you know, taking a couple seconds to learn their story. And
it's true.
I mean, that opportunity is there for you every single day. So that's cool.
Yeah. No, it's been true, man. It has been a huge blessing to have it and have the culture that we have here. But we have people like you speak in. It's really fun. I think one of the things that people have really appreciated is some people ask me why all the time. Why are you doing men's nights or why are you doing that? I've never seen this before. And it's like, because that's why we're here.
Yeah.
Like you can't say you're a community brewery and just want to pour beer. We can pour beer at our house. Like I can do that anywhere. I want to be a part of the community. And how can I help the community that I'm a part of? Well, I should know I'm living in it. I can see it. It's just being courageous enough to go ahead and just do it. You know?
And if there's guys out there that, I mean, they may be thinking, you know, why are you having men's night? My challenge for them is come check it out.
Yeah.
Spend a little time, you know, listen to a speaker, have a couple beers and network with some guys. You'll see what it's all about.
Yeah. Because after you got done speaking, there's guys that came up to you, man, that you impacted them.
Yeah. I even had some guys reach out on social media several days after, you know, and I'm like, if there's one guy out there that heard something that I said and it's made a difference in their life, it's all worth it.
That's
you know?
Right.
So when you have people waiting for you, when you get off stage, man, that's a pretty cool feeling.
I had a few people come up to me afterwards and like, man, that guy, I've been thinking about that guy you know, I have a 41 Club member here that came, and he was like, man, I've been thinking about that guy all week. Like, it actually got me out of my funk a little bit, and I'm fine. My family, my house, my job, and be like, you got problems? He's like, I do. And it kind of got me out of my funk, man. Like, it was actually really great. So awesome. You impact a lot of people, man. So I appreciate you, and I appreciate you coming on to Built for the Storm podcast, man. This is great.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
And again, one more time, if they want to check out your story, get your book, where are they going
to
go?
Yep. You can go to my website, TysonBieber.com. There's a link there. Excuse me. Link there that has, you know, a link to the book. It's on Amazon. That's the only place we sell it. There's a link on my website that'll direct you straight over to Amazon for it.
And if you're not looking at the podcast title right now, spelling on Tyson Devers.
Yep. TysonDever. And then again, the book is Trauma is a Team Sport.
TysonDever.com. Check him out, man. He's awesome. Like I said, I don't just bring anybody on here. I'm not saying I'm that big of a podcast, but I pick and choose who I have on. He was special for my brewery, for my men's night. Great story. And this is perfect for our world right now, but especially our country and probably a lot of communities that we're in. We're seeing this daily. So thank you for listening. Tyson, thank you for coming out, my man. I appreciate it, brother.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you next time on Built for the Storm podcast.
You've been dialed into the Built for the Storm podcast with Jeremy Affeld.
And he strikes out. That's four straight for Affeld. Can't do it any better than Jeremy Affeld.
If you like what you heard, please like, rate, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify today.
Jeremy Affeld here for Free Roam Brewing Company. Do you enjoy craft beer? I do. So I started Free Roam Brewing Company. Our logo, environment, and community all reflect the mighty buffalo, a creature built for the storm. It symbolizes inner strength, perseverance, and a love of freedom. Here at Free Roam Brewing Company, we are determined to strengthen our community through the love of craft beer. Our premium quality lagers and ales reflect the diverse experiences and tastes of our community. In a boundless world of potential beer styles, we cherish the freedom to roam. So if you're in the Burnie area, whether local or passing through, join us on Main Street and enjoy your freedom. Jeremy Affeld here for the Hotel Via. I know you've heard it's at the intersection of sports, technology, and entertainment. But for me, it's my home away from home when I visit San Francisco. I can give you 50 great reasons why I chose Hotel Via, but it's easier for me to say it provides all the comforts of home, family owned and operated, and of course, it's across from the beautiful Oracle Park. So when you're coming to San Francisco for business, pleasure, vacation, or just coming to a sporting event, check in to the Hotel Via.